So, homework number four has been assigned. It's on the webpage. I just haven't got around to sending the email out telling you that it has links to 8 different Bayesian programs, some of which are very specialized or old, but a number of them will be quite usable. So if you need to find Bayesian programs, that's a good place to start, or you can go to my biology programs web pages, which are now somewhat themselves out of date. But anyway, and they're due a week from today. I will hope to get the previous homework back to you Friday. That's not a commitment, and that's not a legally binding commitment, but we'll try. Okay, so we were talking about, which is teacher euphemism for saying I was talking about, likelihood surfaces. When you have large amounts of data, you get into this asymptotic realm in which they look normally distributed, and then it's possible to come up with a rule for if you test, if you have a certain number of parameters varying, how far down the likelihood surface you go before you get a tree that's implausible. Now, that's a bad way of putting it. Another way of saying is, if you maximize the likelihood with respect to all the parameters you've got, you get to the highest point. Of course, the truth won't be at that highest point. It'll be somewhere nearby, hopefully. One issue is, how far down the likelihood surface is the truth going to be? And in general, the likelihood ratio test will allow you to do that. If somebody comes along and says, well, I think that the tree is this one, including these branch lengths, then you can use the number, they have specified a certain number of the parameters. When you specify the parameters and you sort of say, well, we're not going to look at the parameters you estimate, we'll look at these ones that I've provided you with. You'll be specifying a tree which isn't at the maximum, and depending on the number of parameters that you've constrained, you will be going down the likelihood surface to various extents. Probably the simplest thing to remind you of here is these pictures here, where you had two dimensions, you had two variables that were varying, you find the best values for those, you get the maximum likelihood here. But if somebody comes along and says, well, let's say that this value here is 0.3, is that implausible? So you take the value 0.3 and you go up here and you get various likelihoods, the highest of which might be about here. And then you'll say, well, if this is actually true, what is the expected distribution of the likelihood ratio, the ratio of those likelihoods? Well, the ratio of likelihoods, if you take logarithms, will be the difference of the log likelihoods. And the rule is the true value will, if you take the difference in log likelihoods and double it, the true value will be distributed at that double difference will be distributed as a chi-square distribution with a number of degrees of freedom equal to the number of parameters whose values you are giving. Now, if you look at the molecular clock, which is what we were looking at here, what you have is a tree with 7 parameters, the 7 branch lengths. Again, the tree topology is officially not a parameter. And if I say, well, it could be any tree, you can have any values of these, except I'm going to insist on a molecular clock. by doing that, I constrain V1 to be equal to V2. I constrain V4 to be equal to V5. I constrain V3 plus V7 to be equal to V4 plus V8. And because of the other constraints, that means V3 plus V7 is equal to V5 plus V8 as well. And because of this, V1 plus V6 being equal to V3 and V1 being equal to V2, it also follows that V2 plus V6 is equal to V3. So you have a whole bunch of, you've specified some of these numbers, and what it amounts to is if you use these three here, you have in effect restricted the dimensionality of these values of parameters from a total of, well, we'll get back to what the total is in a second, from the total number you see before you to three fewer, because you've constrained three parameters. You've forced V2 to be equal to V1, V5 to be equal to V4, V3 to be equal to that. So you've constrained by three parameters. And it will turn out that the correct number of degrees of freedom for the chi-square is then 3. Now, if you look at this closely, you'll say, oh, wait a second. First of all, isn't it true that we have 8 parameters here, not 7? And the answer is no, there are 7, because if I don't have a clock, in the unconstrained case, I estimate V1, V2, V3, V4, V5, V6, and I don't estimate V7 and V8 separately. I just estimate the total branch length there. So there really are 7 parameters for the unrooted tree. When you make the rooted tree, you constrain V7 and V8 to have this be true, but you never really estimated V7 and V8 separately in the first place. It turns out that this constraint isn't really a constraint on the parameters you estimated before, which is just this total. So people can come up and argue with me after this, but the number of parameters in this tree, if it has n tips, there are in the unrooted tree 2n-3 parameters. So unrooted 2n-3, and the rooted tree with a clock, n-1 parameters, and the difference in those is the number of parameters you're constraining, and that will be n-2. And if you work out various small cases, you'll see that does in fact provide a correct count. I want to be precise about this because in my first paper on maximum likelihood inference with DNA sequences, I got it wrong. I said n-1, but it isn't for a clock, it's n-2. Okay, so if you want to apply this and say, okay, we're going to enforce a clock. By enforcing a clock, we're not allowing it to search among all possible trees. We're restricting it to a subspace that is, in this case, 3 dimensions fewer. The case I want to deal with here is a 7-species mitochondrial DNA case, the great apes plus bovine, that's human, chimp, gorilla. In this case, it's a human, a chimp, gorilla, orang, and a gibbon. That's 5, plus cow and mouse. So there's 7 species in all. And what you'll get is on this Hasegawa data set, but using an F84 model and setting the transition transversion ratio to 30, which is somewhere near its optimal value in a larger tree, then what you find is that the no clock log likelihood is -1372.77, When you constrain to a clock, you get a lower number, which is minus 1414. And of course, your eyeballs tends to say, hey, that's a bigger number. No, there's a minus sign. It's a lower number. The difference between those, 41.67, if you double that difference, you get 83.35. So now we're going to say a chi-square with n minus 2 degrees of freedom, that's going to be a chi-square with 5 degrees of freedom. Let's look it up on a chi-square table. Well, chi-square values, their expectation is the number of degrees of freedom. So they're on average, they're on average 5. Well, this value is 83, and that immediately gives you a hint that it's likely to be way out in the tail. So in fact, this test finds that the clock is rejected very, very significantly. There's very strong rejection of the clock here. Something is non-clock-like in that tree. So by doing a likelihood ratio test, you do the most comprehensive test of whether or not there is a molecular clock on that particular molecule in that particular bunch of species. And it is one of these questions of, is the tree further down the likelihood surface than would just occur at random based on optimizing that number of parameters. So this is a nice test. And not too hard to do. You just have a program that enforces a clock, a program that doesn't enforce a clock, or an option that doesn't enforce a clock. Get the two likelihoods, do this. However, big qualification. The two trees should be of the same topology. Why? Well, the mathematical theory involved, let me just peek ahead. Yeah, the mathematical theory involved is of what happens if you take a, let me try to use this. You take a null hypothesis. Well, you take some values of parameters, and you find the maximum likelihood point among them. Okay. The restriction is that if you place a restriction so that, let's say, you're on this line, you're forcing these two parameters to be linearly related to each other, the mathematical theory only works if the thing that you're the restricted hypothesis is inside the space of the full hypothesis. And that's true if you kind of constraining branch lengths on a single topology. It's not true if you go to another topology. So when you get a clock-like tree that has a different topology than the unclock-like tree, the test is officially not valid. So that makes it, you know, if you have large amounts of data, that won't happen. But with smallish amounts of data, it's not particularly hard to happen. So with that qualification, that the tree topology is of the constrained tree is really the same as of the unconstrained tree, you can do that. Okay. Now, you might say, okay, but can we do some kind of what about larger collections of hypotheses? Let's put it this way. And here we have an example using that same data set. I think here we're using a 14 species data set, just looking at the number of parameters. Let me see if I get this right. Yeah. Yeah, because with the Jukes-Cantor hypothesis, with the Jukes-Cantor model, there's a total in that data set of 14 species of primates. So the number, and the number of branches that whose lengths you have to optimize in the unrooted tree is then 2n minus 3, and 2n minus 3 will be 25. So this, I'm fairly sure, these numbers are going to be 4, the 14 species data set. If I take a bunch of models, suppose I take a bunch of models and I say, I want to test them against each other. Now those models are nested. That is, the more restrictive models are inside the space of the less restrictive ones. So for example, Jukes-Cantor is a model where basically you just have the branch length as the only parameter. The branch lengths is the only parameters. You have one overall rate of change parameter, but that gets absorbed into the branch lengths, which have the rate of change in them. I'm sorry, I have to say it that unclearly. F81 is a model that has base frequencies as well, so there's three more parameters. Jukes-Cantor is then the specialization of F81 to the case where the frequencies of the bases are equal. That restricts three parameters, not four, because they have to add up to one. Well, you could do a likelihood ratio test between F81 and Jukes-Cantor, and when you do, what these fat arrows mean is it rejects the simpler one and prefers F81. Okay, that's a legitimate likelihood ratio test. You can take a Kimura two-parameter model with a fixed transition transversion ratio of two, let's say. That has as few parameters as a Jukes-Cantor model because you fix one of them. You can also estimate T, the transition transversion ratio. When you do that, you find that you do not reject this one. When you take this one and you say, let's use not the Kimura two-parameter model, but let's allow base frequencies to change, we get an F84 model. Let's say we're using F84 as a more general model. We get the F84 model, and it is preferred. This one is rejected. Kimura two-parameter is rejected in favor of an F84 with Kimura two-parameter with a ratio of two is rejected in favor of an F84 with a ratio of two, and so on. So you have this diagram. The one issue is then, well, how do we put all this together, and how do we find the parameter, the model that is actually preferred among all of these? If you try to do it by sort of looking at individual arrows here, it's very easy to get into trouble. It's very easy to come up with somewhat contradictory patterns. What I want to show you, basically will be the last thing in this likelihood ratio stuff, is a framework that solves that problem, and that's the Akaika information criteria. By the way, the AI is not, Akaika was from Japan, and I mean, he worked in Japan, and so these two vowels are not combined into A. It's not a Akaika. It's Akaika, basically. The Akaika information criterion is a scheme in which you take the log likelihood and you basically, you can always, by putting more parameters in the model, you can always get at least a little bit higher likelihood. But the Akaika information criteria discounts the likelihood for the number of parameters that you use. And it happens that the rule is essentially to reduce the log likelihood by the number of parameters that you're estimating. Now, it won't be obvious from this formula here that that's what's being done. But instead of minus twice the log likelihood, you then have minus twice the log likelihood plus twice the number of parameters. If you're trying to find high likelihoods, this quantity is to be minimized, not maximized. Obviously, you could change the sign of it if you wanted and make a quantity that you maximize. But the convention is to take this. So it's minus twice the log likelihood plus twice the number of parameters you're estimating. So if we take all these models, the one you saw in the previous figure, we have a log likelihood minus 3, this is for 14 species data. For Jukes-Cantor, minus 3068.29. there are 25 parameters in all being estimated in that tree. That's 25 branch lengths, basically. So applying this formula, what you get is 6,186.58. Okay. Now, if you restrict, if you take another model, which is Kimura 2 parameter, but with an R of 2.0, you get a little bit better likelihood, minus 2953.15, with 25 parameters, and when you compute the formula, you basically do minus twice that, plus twice this, you get 5956. And it, you can do this for all of these models. And when you do, you get this bunch of these numbers. And the rule in the Akaik information criterion is that you should prefer the hypothesis which has the lowest value of this AIC. So it's actually the bottom one. It's the F84 model with a particular value of the transition-transversion ratio that you've, in this case, estimated. And you'll get a value of 5,290. Looking naively at the log likelihoods, you would also prefer that, but that's giving you. But that's not taking into account the fact that some of them have you estimating more parameters. So what this is supposed to do is put some restraint on you adding lots and lots and lots of parameters to the model, because this 2p term increases the quantity by twice the number of parameters. The whole question of these Akaik information criterion, and then there are some variants, there's a thing called Bayes information criterion, and there's some others that I keep forgetting, and they all have slightly different formulas for this trade-off between log likelihood and parameter values. They can be used when the models are not perfectly nested. For example, you can compare Jukes-Kander to the Kimura 2 parameter with a transition transversion ratio of 2. Those are not nested within each other, but according to the theory underlying Akaik information criteria, this is a legitimate comparison, and you're allowed to do that. I shouldn't say more on Akaik information criterion because I don't entirely understand it. I don't entirely understand where the theory comes from. Perhaps some mathematically, statistically enlightened person will clear me up on it. So anyway, we have this theory of likelihood ratio test. It's tremendously useful, except that it insists that the parameter, that the hypothesis, the restricted hypothesis, be nested within the other. It therefore does not give you a means of testing one tree topology against another. When you don't have nested hypotheses, you can use Akaik information criterion. It tells you which is to be preferred. It doesn't necessarily tell you by how much it's preferred. It doesn't necessarily tell you that which ones you can reject here, but it tells you that this one is the best. And at least it compensates to some extent for having extra parameters in some models compared to others. Okay, I think I'm going to get myself in trouble if I keep talking about this. Yeah.
You can use the Akaik method to compare non-nested models?
Yes, these are not. Many of these are not nested. That is, K2P compared to Jukes-Kander is not a subcase of Jukes-Kander. Jukes-Kander is not a subcase of it either.
Right.
But it does compare these two numbers and say, of those two, this is the preferable one.
And different topologies, or?
And I believe different topologies, too. But what it tells you is which topology you would prefer. It doesn't tell you by whether it's by a significant amount, as far as I know.
Someone can straighten me out on that, and I'd be grateful if they would. Okay, so that's a quick tour of likelihood ratio tests, which do some of the things you want, but they don't do others. They're not, for example, very useful when there are different tree topologies and you want to compare them with each other. And there's this AIC machinery that is supposed to get you partway there, at least tell you which is the preferred hypothesis among a whole set of possibly non-nested hypotheses. Okay. What I want to do is shift from that to the bootstrap which is a completely different, it's a, at this point we say a now for something completely different. Oh yeah, no, I'm not shifting to the bootstrap, I'm sorry. I'm showing you this diagram, which I showed you once before. Back to the likelihood ratio test. You might think that there is a way of test of rejecting tree topologies. Here is a case, this is for somewhat artificial data, for three species. We're estimating rooted clock-like trees just because I needed a very simple case. In that case, if you look at the tree topology, let's say you look at one of these like this one, and you ask, well, how many parameters are there for branch lengths there? And the answer really is two. There's the length down to this node here, then there's the further length down to that node. And the entire, all the branch lengths are specified by those two numbers. So there is, there are in this case, three different tree topologies, and each one is a two-dimensional space. Now, what I'm showing you here is not that full situation because I only have two dimensions on this projection screen. What I can do is say, let's think of the two-dimensional likelihood, the likelihood surface that rises above a two-dimensional space, which are the branch lengths. So it's kind of like a mountain range. And what we're going to do is do what's called a profile likelihood, which is very, very similar to what you see if you look across Puget Sound, and there is the Olympics that rise above a two-dimensional surface, and we look at them and we see a profile. We see a skyline, and what this is saying for different values of one of those parameters, the interior branch here, what is the highest possible likelihood we could find when fiddling with the other parameter? So we're looking and we could see the t value, but there's another parameter going back from that, and we're looking at the profile likelihood. We're looking at the highest likelihood. This is the highest likelihood we could find for that value of t, allowing the other one to be whatever value we want, finding the best value for the other parameter. Okay, so you get a sense that there are these three tree topologies, each of which has a two-dimensional likelihood. We're just looking at its profile, and we'll see a highest peak here. That's the highest peak within that tree topology. It has a value of, I don't know, 0.07 or something. For this tree topology, we also have a peak within that tree topology. There's the highest value. For the third one, there really isn't any peak. As you increase t, it just dives downwards. Doesn't have any peak. And they all connect at this value, which is where t equals 0. That's the trifurcation. When you have t equals 0, you have a trifurcation. And the highest possible likelihood for that is here. Now you might think, look, if I take this tree topology and I ask myself, can I reject that tree topology? Maybe all I have to do is reject the value of 0 for t. Well, I can look over here and say, how far down do we have to go to get to t equals 0? T equals 0 is the nearest point that is also in that other tree topology. Well, if you try to do a likelihood ratio test on that, you'll find that, yes, you can test against the possibility that t equals 0, except that t is not in the restricted hypothesis, is not in the interior of the space. It's at the end of it, which immediately indicates that something is funny, and the likelihood ratio test might not be valid against t equals 0. But furthermore, you can see that going to t equals 0, the likelihood drops away. But once you get into the other tree topology, it rises up again. And it's clear that looking to see whether a value of t equals 0 is OK is not going to give you a very clear idea of how high this peak over here might be. It might even be higher than this one.
So don't try to test tree topology by just testing whether an interior branch can assume a value of zero and get you to the edge of the space of the nearby topology. That's basically the lesson for this. Again, I think if I talk further about this, I'm going to get myself in trouble because I sort of understand it, sort of. But this, the other thing you can see is that cases like this can occur. You can have multiple peaks in different tree topologies, often nearby ones, but sometimes ones further away. And it's not true if you try to look, if you're, for example, in this tree topology and you go to the local peak of the likelihood and you say to yourself, is that the highest likelihood in the whole space? Somebody might say, well, just try to keep going uphill until you get into the highest tree topology. Here it won't work, because in order to get to that one, you're going to have to dive down and pass through that valley. So it is not true that you can always sort of fiddle with trees and wander your way to the highest peak. And it is not true that you can use likelihood ratio tests. If you try to use a likelihood ratio test, ignoring the fact that these two tree topologies are not one nested within the other, they're co-equal, if you try to do that, you'll say, okay, I'll look at the difference in log likelihoods, I'll double it, I'll go to a chi-square, how many degrees of freedom do we have? And the answer is the difference in the number of parameters. Then you look at it and say, wait a second, both of those have the same number of parameters. The difference is zero. Where's the table for a chi-square with 0 degrees of freedom? And there isn't any. So you can immediately see that something is wrong if you try to test trees of different topology by doing a likelihood ratio test. Okay. That is all I'm going to say about likelihood ratio tests. I'm going to move on to the bootstrap because it is also important. You have already done the bootstrap, so you may start to get some feel for how it works. What I want to do is start by showing you what it is in a simpler case that doesn't involve phylogenies, that just involves distributions, and then talk about how we apply this to, how do we apply it to phylogenies. The bootstrap is a statistical resampling method invented by Bradley Ephron of Stanford University in 1979, published in 1979, and it's generally applicable to lots of situations. Here I want to show you a situation involving an unknown true distribution, which happens in reality to be a mixture of two normal distributions. These are actual numbers, actually sampled from the actual distribution. They're not just the artist's conception. So what I have is a mixture of 60% from this normal peak and 40% from that normal peak. They have different means, which are shown here. I forget what the actual numbers are, but I got it somewhere. I think this might be like 6 and that might be 10. They have equal standard deviations. So we have this kind of weird bumpy distribution. And there are two cases that we might be interested in, one of which is where we don't know what the distribution is. We're not sure what family it came from. That's certainly an important case. The other is we know the distribution, but our statistical estimator is such a complicated function of the data that we're not really sure how it's distributed. But let's just think of the case where we don't know what the true distribution is. And what we want to do is we're going to have a sample of 150 data points from this distribution. And we're going to try to estimate, in this case, the expectation, the true mean of this mixture of distributions. It happens to be here in truth, which we don't know. Okay. Now, if I take a sample of 150 data points from that, and I make a histogram of it, here it is. You can see there's two bulges there. If we take the mean of this sample, there it is. That's a mean, which is our estimate of this theta thing. What we want to know is how uncertain is our estimate. Now, normally when you work pun intended, normally when you work, if you get something like knowing what the true distribution is, you know it's a normal distribution, you can use statistical theory to answer that question. Here we got some maybe more complicated distribution. We have independent samples from it. The independence is important. We have, in this case, 150 of them. And now we're going to say, okay, I'd like to know if I went out to this distribution and did it again, how different would the estimate of theta be? Suppose I did it again 1,000 times. Each time I got 150 data points and I estimated theta. Now, if I could do that, then two things. One, I'd get a very good idea of the uncertainty of theta. Okay. But I kind of wouldn't need to ask the question, because I've got then, instead of 150 data points, I'd have 150,000 data points. And I'd have a much, much more precise estimate of what theta was, and asking what the uncertainty of the estimate from 150 data points would be of no further interest to me. If I can always go back and get more and more and more and more points from that distribution, I'm in great shape, and I can really find the true value of theta to almost any precision I want. Okay, but we're stuck. We've only got these 150 data points. We can't go back and draw from the true unknown distribution. All we've got are them. What can we do then? And Bradley Effron had the following insight. He said, well, the data sample is large enough. Its variability within that sample gives you a picture of what, you know, the variability in the unknown true distribution. For example, the sort of width apart of these points has something to do with the width apart of those points. Let us pretend that we are sampling additional data, but we can't go back to the original distribution. Let's go back to this distribution. Let's say that that histogram is the true distribution, and let's draw samples of 150 data points from, well, not the true distribution, but anyway, from the empirical distribution over here. And let's ask how much the estimates of theta vary as we do that, many, many, many times. Got to be careful here as to what's being done how many times. What he said was, draw samples that are the same size, 150 data points, from this distribution. There's two ways you could draw. One would be without replacement, and one would be with replacement. Okay. What happens if I draw 150 data points from this distribution without replacement? You get the same set of points. There's only 150 there, so if you keep drawing them and don't replace them, sooner or later you draw every one exactly once. And then it's you just get the same data points that just happen to have arrived in a different order, which isn't important. So doing the without replacement is a completely uninteresting exercise. It just gets you the same data set again. But drawing them with replacement is not so bad, because drawing them with replacement is saying that this is the true underlying distribution. We're pretending it's the true underlying distribution. We can draw a sample of 150. Here it is. Here's an actual sample of 150 made into a histogram. And we can take their mean and get an estimate of theta. Because we're saying, well, let's pretend it's the true distribution. If it's the true distribution, that's its shape. Drawing one doesn't change its shape, so we keep drawing with replacement. So here is a bootstrap sample. It has to be the same size, and it's drawn from the empirical distribution, and then you can estimate what theta is, and it will not come out exactly the same. If you drew without replacement, you just get the same data points, their mean is the same, nothing is very interesting. Here it varies. If we do it again, another 150, and again another 150, each time we get a histogram, each time they sort of give you an impression of the two peaks. Each time the width of them is about right, and there's estimated means, and I was very careful in drawing this figure. Those estimated means are a little different from each other, and if you line them up precisely, you'll see that here they are. So you can start to get an estimate, start to get an idea of how uncertain your estimate of, in this case, theta, really is. You have to start with a large enough distribution that you think that it's giving you a fair picture of the underlying distribution. So you don't want to do this when you have only 5 data points or anything. But when you have 150, not so bad. You can do it. And you can get these bootstrap replicates, each of which is a draw of the same number of data points as the original data with replacement. Please.
Is there a statistical or mathematical way of telling if your sample size is big enough? Or is it just...
The big enough sample size, it's just like all statistical theory that has an asymptotic justification. The correct big enough sample size is infinity. Okay. Then everything will work really, really, really well. Well, partly because then you'll really be drawing from the original distribution. And there is an asymptotic justification that says it's kind of close the closer you get to infinity. And then beyond that, I think it gets hairier to try to know. I think that I think I shouldn't say more, because if I do, I'm going to get myself in trouble. But that's a great question to have asked, and a good moment to ask it. Okay, so you say, with the bootstrap in general, you can do this, not knowing what this distribution is, what weird family it comes from. You can always sample from the data set the same number of times, get bootstrap ones, and do this many, 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 many times and get an idea what this distribution looks like. Okay. People may say, oh, how many of these bootstrap samples should you take? And again, the correct answer is infinity. You do it until you get tired. You do it until your money runs out. But, as we'll see, you don't usually need to do it more than about, 1,000 times. Okay, what about phylogenies? How do we do bootstraps on phylogenies? The thing is to use the fact that in the simple simple models of phylogenies, individual sites are evolving independently. Now, I know I told you of some cases, the hidden Markov model machinery, for example, where there are correlations between the outcomes at neighboring sites. But I want you to, for the moment, erase those from your mind and just consider cases where each column of the data matrix, each site in the alignment, is independently evolving on the true unknown tree, on the same true unknown tree. So these columns in the original sequences are independent draws from some kind of complicated distribution. Okay, so you say, okay, I have independent data points. How many of them? I have as many as there are sites. So if I have an alignment of 1,000 sites, it's as if I had 1,000 data points. And each point is a whole column. Okay, so what do? We say, I want to make up, we do not have accessible to us to go back to the true tree and draw from that. Why? Because if we knew the true tree, we wouldn't even need the data. We'd have the answer, and we wouldn't, all the statistics would be completely unnecessary. We're never in that case. So what we do is we want to make up a data set of the same size, the same number of columns. So it'll be a fake alignment. And we want to do it by drawing sites with replacement from the original sequences. So, for example, the first draw might be from this column. So we take that column and we copy it down. By the way, keeping the species in the same order. Second draw we make might be from this column. Third draw we make might be again that one. You can get the same column again, quite possible. And you start to build up this data set down here. And you keep going until you've drawn 1,000 times, in the case of when you start with the alignment of 1,000 sites. So you get this bootstrap sampled data set, this bootstrap sampled sequence alignment. Now, with the original data set, you ran some sort of phylogeny program and you get a tree. You might do a distance method, you might do a parsimony method, you might do a likelihood method. So what do? We get the bootstrap sample data set and we run the same algorithm and get an estimate of the tree from that. Now that's bootstrap sample number one. Bootstrap sample number two, you just start the whole process over again. You go back and you draw 1,000 columns from 1,000 columns with replacement. And that's these dash draws, and there they are, they're building up 1,000 column data set. And when you're finished getting it, you run the tree program and get a tree out. And you keep going. And you keep going until your patience or your money or both run out. Okay. And now you have a very interesting thing. You have a cloud of trees. If you had to, let's say your patients ran out after drawing 250 bootstrap samples, you now have 250 trees. And they are a fair sample of the uncertainty of the tree in both topology and branch lengths. They're not really drawn from the original distribution, they're drawn from the empirical distribution you got in your original alignment. Okay, so the question arises, how do we get the samples of trees? We got them. We got a whole big cloud of trees. Now, how do we say something sensible about that cloud of trees? And there where we're going is to say, we're going to look at particular clades or particular partitions of species and ask how often they occur. So for example, if we want to know whether the closest relative of, let's say we got one chimpanzee and we got one human, and we say to ourselves, we really want to know whether humans and chimps are sister species on that tree. That means there will be a branch that separates human and chimp on the one hand from everybody else on the other. And that is a partitioning of the species. If we're making unrooted trees, that is partitioning the species into two groups and saying that there is a branch which has the first bunch connected to the one end and the second bunch connected to the other end. So what I'm going to show you, and we'll start off with that next time, is if you got a bunch of these bootstrap estimates, how can we go through in a sufficiently reasonable and organized way and tote up how many times different partitions of species occur in that data, in those trees? And here we see the start of the thing. I've taken one of those five trees and I've looked at this branch here and I've said, well, it separates BD from ACEF. And we can list that partition, here's ACEF and the bar and BD, and say, well, we saw that once. And we're gonna go through these trees and see how many times we see each possible partition. And then I'm gonna show you a reasonable way of summarizing that by making a single tree and putting bootstrap values on it. So we'll pick that up there. You go out, you're going to find you have to struggle a bit to run Bayesian programs, so get to it and don't leave it to the last day. But you have links. I should also say, on my browser, when I clicked on those links, it immediately said, are you sure you want to follow this mysterious, horrible link? Just follow it, it's okay. None of those sites are dangerous.